President Obama recently announced a proposal for the world's largest marine preserve in the Pacific Ocean in the area between Hawaii and American Samoa.
The effort's intended to protect those waters from fishing, drilling, and other actions that could harm the marine ecosystem. The move comes as the Global Ocean Commission released a report calling the world's oceans a, quote, degraded, underproductive and exploited system.
Phil Dustin joins us now. He's a professor of biology at the College of Charleston. He's a marine ecologist who specializes in coral reefs. Phil, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm talking to you from here in Wisconsin. You're near the ocean in South Carolina. What do you want people to know who might not think about their ocean in their daily lives, about how the oceans are doing today?
You know, I think the first thing we have to realize is we owe life on Earth to oceans. Without oceans, we wouldn't have life that we have on Earth at all. And the oceans really then are central to our well-being on this planet. You know, our blood is almost like seawater. Life came from the sea, and now we sort of look at the sea as something that we can just utilize when, in fact, we're really part of it.
President Obama just announced plans for what would be the world's largest marine preserve in the Pacific Ocean. What do you make of that idea?
I think it's about time. As a matter of fact, it's past time. The oceans are amazing. If you took everything that we have put in the oceans and piled it up on land, the Earth would be uninhabitable. And just think about that for a minute. Think of all the various kinds of waste and dumps and everything we put in the ocean. And still the ocean is resilient. And what we found is when you leave the ocean alone, it can rebound. And so having marine protected areas, very large ones, especially out in the open sea as well as near shore, very, very important. So I think it's a very significant thing he's doing.
Well, it's an interesting thing. Here in the United States, we have national parks, we have state parks. Why aren't there more marine preserves globally?
Well, you know, again, it goes back to we protect what we own and we protect what we think is of value. And we do have this idea of an exclusive economic zone around countries, and we use that to protect our marine resources. But there is no real governance of the ocean. And it goes back to trying to have international conventional law of the sea, probably 20, 30 years ago, I think we began that, or maybe a little earlier. Trying to get some sort of agreement of nations to have some sort of governance in the ocean. And really right now, it's just a free-for-all.
Meaning people can just plunder what they wish and not worry about the consequences.
That's right. Once you get out into the open ocean, nobody owns it. So you can go out there and do whatever you want. And I mean, we do have some issues if you want to go out and blow up nuclear bombs or dump hazardous waste in the ocean. But for the most part, we don't really have some sort of governance to protect the ocean.
That's pretty remarkable when you consider how much of the planet Earth is comprised of oceans.
Not only that, Veronica, but when you think of what the oceans are worth to us, two-thirds of the planet's surface is water. And then there was a valuation of the Earth's goods and services. You know, these are the things that ecosystems provide for free to us, things like fresh air and oxygen to breathe and processing carbon dioxide and generating food. And the value of the Earth's resources, goods and services, in 1997 dollars was about $33 trillion, more than all the economies of all the world's nations at the time. And the oceans made up 67% of that.
Wow.
So $20.9 trillion. And they do that for free. So we really ought to start valuing that and realizing how precious it is rather than just seeing it as something we can exploit.
Well, there is this new report from the Global Ocean Commission that says that the oceans are, and this is a quote, they're degraded and underproductive as an ecosystem. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yes, I do. I really do, especially the parts of the ocean that I have intimate contact with. And those mostly are coral reefs. And if you use those reefs as, sort of look at them as the most productive parts of the ocean and the places where the greatest different kinds of life exist, you know, the highest biodiversity, those are the places that are changing the most. And so we're seeing them as sort of like the canary in a cage that the miner would take into the coal mine as an indicator of the health of the ocean. And we see degradation occurring all around the world at astonishing rates. And every fishery in the world's oceans pretty much is overfished. We have more and more people placing a greater demand on the sea. And it's gotten to the point where we have to take an active role in trying to ensure the health of the oceans.
You're talking about coral reefs, and it's an area that you specialize in. And we sometimes, as you say, we look at them as a barometer of an ocean's health. They're supposed to be incredibly beautiful. I've never seen one. Can you describe for us what a healthy coral reef looks like?
Oh, yeah. Have you walked in a forest?
Oh, yeah.
You know, when you walk in a forest, the structure of the forest is generated by plants, mostly large trees and small bushes. And then you have all these beautiful flowers in the understory and ferns and all of the various small plants that fill in the forest. Well, when you go swimming on a coral reef, you're effectively swimming over the canopy of one of the most beautiful underwater forests you could ever imagine. And the corals are usually brown and white and different colors, and they build the structure. And they're essentially living rocks. They're very thin, fragile calcium carbonate skeletons they build, and their tissues on the outside of them. So you have this like swimming through a beautiful flower garden. And then there are all kinds of fabulous swarms of insects that are really fish. You know, you have all these different colors of fish. And in some places, the fish live in the corals, like different birds and insects live in different kinds of trees. They are absolutely, you know, a profusion of life. As one of my mentors, Captain Cousteau, would say. He'd say there's this exuberance of life on a coral reef that we can't replace.
So you're talking about Jacques Cousteau, right?
Yeah, Jacques Cousteau.
What was it like working with him?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was wonderful because he allowed everybody to use their talents to create something. And we would go off underwater and he would have a camera, and I would be the marine biologist, and we'd go explore the reef and find interesting things to photograph. And it really, his shows weren't really done with a script in mind. It was done with the idea, let's go out and see what's here, and then let's show the people that don't scuba dive what it's like.
Well, one of the things he did was he helped people fall in love with the oceans because he introduced them to the oceans, to places that they had never seen, you know, the deep sea before, and the creatures that live there. Do you think that as a country, as a world, that we're still in love with the oceans, or have we lost the thread of that?
You know, more important than our love of the oceans, Captain Cousteau showed us that the oceans are alive. Before his work, we always thought of the oceans as just this big puddle of water that we get fish from and we can extract things from. And so he taught us more about cherishing the oceans and that they're alive, like you said, the love. My whole generation of marine biologists fell in love with the ocean because of his shows. And now we've sort of walked away from that a little bit. We've sort of regenerated our economy, and we're looking at exploitation, and more people go out and want to extract fish and minerals and oil. And so we've walked away a little bit, I think, from that feeling that we all had. And we've done that in many aspects of the biosphere because we feel that money is more important than nature. And one of the magical things is if somebody were to give you the goods and services of the earth, if they said, here's $33 trillion, and you got the best scientists and the best engineers in the world, and you said, here's $33 trillion, build me a biosphere, we couldn't begin to do it. We could not. So the idea is the long term has no price. It doesn't matter how much we think it's worth. What we really need to do is keep it functioning so we can live here.
We're talking right now about the health of the oceans right now. In light of news that President Obama wants to create the world's biggest marine reserve in the Pacific Ocean, Phil Dustin stays with us. He's a biology professor at the College of Charleston.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. What concerns do you have about the health of the oceans? Do you have questions about what threats there are to oceans, about life in the oceans, and what can be done to help them? Are you curious about the fishing industry or how ocean health might affect us here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about the health of the oceans right now in light of news that President Obama wants to create the world's biggest marine reserve in the Pacific Ocean.
There's also a new report out from the Global Ocean Commission deploring the state of the world's oceans, offering up a plan to address overfishing, pollution, and other issues. We've got Phil Dustin with us. He's a biology professor at the College of Charleston, specializing in coral reefs. And we can hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. Your thoughts, your questions about the state of the world's oceans. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. Steve is with us from Racine. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I'd like to ask about the Fukushima radiation in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a specific question or just in general?
Well, it's something that, I mean, I have a friend who just came back from Hawaii where he said the cab driver was wearing a Geiger counter, and there's concerns about the fish in the Pacific, and you know that the wildlife. You know, I don't. You look on the web, and you don't know what to believe, if it's what's true or what's how dangerous it is. Or
okay, gotcha, Steve. Thank you for that question. And Phil, can you comment on that?
So some of the large predatory fish have been found to have some radioactive contamination in them. And these are fish that have global ranges. So we have this system at Fukushima that is leaching radioactive, pretty highly toxic radioactive material into the ocean consistently. And from what I can see, it's just flowing into the ocean. And so there's a source. And that source is picked up in the food chain and transfers up into higher levels of the food chain. And I have friends in Hawaii, too, that are marine biologists, and they are talking about not eating any fish out of the Pacific Ocean.
Mm.
So on an interesting side, though, it may actually start to protect some of the large fish that people hunt for prizes, like some of the very large tuna that people think is great for sashimi. If it's radioactive, I don't think people would really think it's so good to eat anymore. So maybe in a strange kind of twisted way, it becomes a conservation tool. You know, if you look what happened around Chernobyl, nature's moved in pretty well. It's moved into that space, and the wolves are back, and there may be some radioactive fallout problems with respect to that, too, and mutations. We don't know about that. But, the whole idea of radioactive nuclear power plants built on faults that can be inundated by tsunamis, to me, is sort of just the epitome of our hubris when we think we can go out and conquer nature.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for that question, Steve, and an interesting answer, too. We'll go next to Patricia in Madison. Hi, Patricia.
Hi. I write a living wildlife column for the Cap Times, and I just did some research on the biosphere and what's happening. And from what I understand, and I'm not sure if the distinction is large mammals or all large fish, that 90% of the top of the food chain in the oceans has been declined, 90% in the last 50 years or so. And also, I also read Jacques Cousteau's last postmortem published book, and he said that the continental shelf, the areas off the coast of our continents, that narrow band around them is where most of the nurseries of life of the ocean are produced, and that's exactly where we drill. So
okay.
I would like answers to the 90% question. Is that like whales and mammals, or is that just big fish?
Right. Let's get Phil Dustin in on this. Phil, about that 90% figure?
So large fish disappearing, large animals disappearing, I don't think you could say it's 89% or 95%, but it's a very, very large number. I once read an essay called We're Killing the Elders. We tend to go out and kill the biggest fish. We chop down the biggest trees. There's this fascination. We want to somehow go out and collect the biggest things. But you're right, very large animals, especially sharks. And for years, we hunted the whales almost to extinction, and some countries still do hunt these large animals. These large animals play a very important role in the ecology of the sea, much the way lions do and wolves do in keeping the stocks healthy. We have the same problem in the ocean, but we tend to go out and hunt that. And we have the technology to hunt most of those large animals. at least sport fishing now, there's a lot of tag and release, and that's a lot better than just catch and kill. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is all these animals that live at the top of the food chain are contaminated with all kinds of our chemicals that we've produced in the last 100 years. As far as the continental shelves having the mysteries, that's where most of the productivity is, because light penetrates and drives the photosynthetic rate on the bottom. Most of the mysteries in the ocean are probably yet to be discovered. And there are fabulous mysteries in deep water and fabulous mysteries in shallow water. And I mean, the shallow water ecosystems that I study are probably some of the most glamorous and mysterious of all. Because remember, we know probably more about the surface of the moon than we do about the bottom of the ocean.
And we have to leave it there. We're out of time. But Phil, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
We've been talking with Phil Dustin, a biology professor at the College of Charleston. He's a marine ecologist who specializes in coral reefs. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about the sport of wife carrying. That's in today's Curious Wisconsin segment.
First, the White House released a 40-page report this week suggesting ways in which states that did not accept a federal Medicaid expansion are missing out.
Wisconsin is one of those states. According to the report, here are some of the benefits Wisconsin isn't getting. 120,000 more Wisconsinites, the report says, would have health insurance, 11,000 more jobs created in 3 years, and the report says the state overall would have more preventative care, fewer financially catastrophic ailments, and Wisconsinites would experience less depression.
When Governor Scott Walker chose not to take federal funds, he went about it in a different way from many other states that rejected the expansion. He moved people who are just over the poverty line off of Badger Care and onto the federal exchanges, and added some previously non-covered adults into Badger Care. According to PolitiFact, the net gain in coverage by the state was about 6,000 people. Here to talk about the White House's report is Kevin Moore, Deputy Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Health Services. Kevin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica. Thank you for having me.
So Governor Walker's main argument for not accepting the federal funds would be that we didn't know if they would be there in the long term, he said. The possibility was there that the state would be left high and dry. Are there indications at this point for the states that did take the expansion that the money is going to run out?
I think that there's still, as the debate about the Affordable Care Act continues to go on in Washington and in states across the country, that will remain something that I think courts are going to be making that decision, as will Congress. But here in Wisconsin, the solution that Governor Walker forwarded really was driven about two things. First of all, creating an entitlement reform, making sure that Wisconsin residents living in poverty have access to Medicaid, and then also utilizing the fact that the Affordable Care Act provided subsidies for individuals all the way down to 100% of the federal poverty level. And so when you look at the solution that the governor put forward, Wisconsin is, despite not taking the Medicaid expansion, Wisconsin is the only state in the country that does not have a gap in coverage. And I think that's what makes Wisconsin unique. And we're starting to see more and more people in Medicaid and more people getting covered in the private market as well.
If Wisconsin had taken the money for the expansion and then it did dry up, as Governor Walker feared, which is a possibility for things that are federally funded, would Wisconsin be any worse off? Is there an argument to be made that taking the money, even if there was a risk, would still have benefited the state?
I think the challenge is just knowing what would that look like in the future and how many people were in the program. And I think that for Governor Walker, the main goal of this was really had nothing to do with really what's coming out of the White House report. It really had to do with making sure that Medicaid was returning to its roots of providing coverage, full coverage, including behavioral health and substance abuse services to those people living in poverty. And I think the reality is, and this is the part that I think is missing in a lot of the discussion, is that the Affordable Care Act, as passed by Congress and signed into law by the president, covered and subsidized individuals down to 100% of the federal poverty level. And so from a coverage perspective, everybody in the Wisconsin is going to have access to affordable health insurance, whether it be through Medicaid if you're in poverty, or whether it be through the health insurance exchanges. And that is really what our focus has been moving forward. And I think it allows Wisconsin, from a budget perspective, to be able to control its own destiny, regardless of what happens either in the courts or in Congress.
Now, critics have said that had the state taken this federal money to expand Medicaid, that the new people brought on would have been covered as well as those who were moved to the exchanges. And so overall, you'd have more coverage. What do you say to that?
This is actually kind of a really good example of not understanding what Wisconsin's Medicaid program is and what the solution that Governor Walker forwarded. The fact of the matter is that the Affordable Care Act provided subsidies both on premiums and cost sharing for people 100% of the federal poverty level all the way up to 400%. It eliminated the ability for people to have be exempted from coverage from pre-existing conditions. All of that was part of the federal Affordable Care Act. What we did in Wisconsin, though, we recognized that the Affordable Care Act missed those individuals from 0 to 100%. So through the governor's reform initiatives, we were able to address those individuals in poverty. And I think it's very important that whether you're at 50% of the federal poverty level or 150% of federal poverty level, you'll either get Medicaid or you'll get coverage through the exchanges. And I think that that's really, it's really not understood. And it's unfortunate when you have national publications go out. I mean, and again, I'll just say this. The Kaiser Commission on the Medicaid and the Uninsured admitted as much, that Wisconsin is the only state that didn't accept Medicaid expansion but still has no gap in coverage. And I think it's important that before we do a broad brush on categorizing Wisconsin, you got to understand what the Wisconsin solution is and really what Governor Walker's vision was, and that we are meeting all of those goals. Full coverage. People, no matter what your income level, you'll have access to affordable health insurance either through the exchanges or through Medicaid.
What does the administration have to say to people who have been moved to the federal exchanges? They have coverage, but they're paying more for that insurance, and they may have less access overall.
Well, I think that at the end of the day, you've got through the exchanges the ability, and again, there are subsidies available for those individuals that they are able to get on both the premium side as well as for the cost-sharing side. But again, those coverages and those benefits are still required by federal law to cover all of the qualified health benefits. And so that ranges everything from preventative medicine, which is something that in the White House report, it has to acknowledge the fact that no matter what policy you purchase, whether it be through Medicaid, through the insurance exchanges, or through your employer, you have to provide these types of qualified health benefits. So from our perspective, again, it's more of we're clearly working to educate folks to let them know, look, if you are eligible for health insurance through the exchanges, let's make sure that you get the right plan either through using some of our certified application counselors, insurance agents, and that allows folks and families, as their income continues to rise, there's a continuity that they can stay with their existing plan. And like I said, for us, the key point was to make sure that we weren't having any gaps in coverage, and the Governor Walker's plan and initiatives really ensure that Wisconsin met that objective.
If we look at overall health outcomes, this mm-hmm. new report, it says that because Wisconsin didn't take the expansion money, that Wisconsin will be less healthy overall, that there will be those with less access to preventive health care, fewer screenings, even more depression. What about looking at it from that angle?
And I think this is a really good example of, again, using a national platform to not fully understand what's going on in Wisconsin. And again, if you take a look at what the governor has put forward on Medicaid, we not only went out there and covered everybody that's living in poverty, we covered them with the standard benefit. That included substance abuse services, that included comprehensive mental health services and behavioral health services. And if you look at everybody that's purchasing through the health insurance exchanges, as in addition to the federal law that requires mental health parity, the reality is that on a lot of the behavioral health and substance abuse health outcomes, it really doesn't make, and nor should it make, a difference whether you're in Medicaid or you're in the private sector health insurance market. These are services that are covered. And in particular, to your point on depression, I think that this is actually an issue that, had there been more research as to what's going on in Wisconsin, there'd be an acknowledgement of the unprecedented investment in behavioral health that Governor Walker and the legislature made, over $30 million in new cash to provide additional community-based services to children and families. And so this has been a huge year in Wisconsin in terms of turning the tide and helping families with behavioral health. And again, I think whether you're in Medicaid or you're in the private health insurance market, again, we are consistent and we will continue to work to make sure women are getting access to mammograms, that men are making sure that they're getting their cancer screens. That is a public health initiative, regardless of whether you're in Medicaid or whether you're in the private sector. And again, as I mentioned before, most of these preventative coverages and most of these preventative services, according to the Affordable Care Act, are mandated and they're covered. And so for us, the bigger issue is how do we make sure that people are making the right decisions, that they're purchasing the health insurance either through the exchanges or those for those in Medicaid that are Medicaid eligible, that we're getting those folks enrolled.
To look at this now for a moment from a different angle, from the jobs angle, mm-hmm. according to this report, over 11,000 jobs would be created in Wisconsin over the next 3 years, again, had the state taken this federal money to expand Medicaid. Governor Walker has said that creating jobs is a top priority for him, and he hasn't met the 250 benchmark that he set for himself. So is there a disconnect between turning down this federal money and his promise to create jobs?
I think, and this is, again, one of those things where you got to look at where the data came from and what the assumptions are made. And the reality is, again, you have to look at the Wisconsin solution and the Wisconsin entitlement reform. The reality is that, yes, there is going to be, and Wisconsin currently is, drawing down significant amount of federal dollars to provide Medicaid coverage for those that are living in poverty. But that there's also a huge amount of federal dollars that are being used to provide subsidies, both on the cost-sharing side and the premium side, for those men and women that are buying insurance, health insurance, through the health insurance exchanges. That money is going to insurance carriers. It's going to providers, more people that are utilizing primary care. They're utilizing hospitals. Hospitals then use that money to increase the number of employees that they have. So I think that from looking at it, again, it's a very disjointed view on this, because there's not a lot of understanding about what Wisconsin did and what Governor Walker promoted and actually successfully implemented, and that at the end of the day, we will have, based on our most recent numbers, we're expecting over 130,000 individuals that are going to be newly eligible for Medicaid. Those are new people that are going to require services, and they are going to require new nurses, new doctors, and new providers throughout the system. So we're pretty confident that as we continue to get coverage, which I think is the most important part, that the economic benefits are going to be seen through communities across Wisconsin.
Now, given what the report says, obviously, you know, there are different ways to interpret this information, but if there is seemingly stable funding from the federal government, as we see unfolding down the road, maybe over the next year or two, is there a chance that the Walker administration could choose to take that money and expand Medicaid?
At this stage in the game, again, where we continue to be very concerned, as long as there are cases before the federal court, whether it be in Washington or across the country, challenging some of the core functions of the Affordable Care Act, I think what our main focus right now is continuing to move forward with the direction that the governor and the legislature has given to the department, which is really not only ensuring that people living in poverty have access to Medicaid, that's obviously something we take very seriously, but we're actually continuing to move forward and preparing for the next open enrollment period, which will be coming up this November 15th, and making sure that we continue to build on our successes last time of ensuring that people who have questions, who have challenges in enrollment, that they are able to access professionals, whether it be insurance agents or application counselors, to meet their needs and answer their questions. So, again, I think there's a lot of instability out there, and those are all issues that will work their way out through both Congress as well as through the White House. But from the administration's perspective and the department's perspective, we're moving forward with the blueprint that's been given to us by the governor and through the legislature.
Kevin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica.
We've been speaking with Kevin Moore, Deputy Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Health Services, about a new White House report suggesting ways that states that rejected Medicaid expansion are missing out.
Well, as I'm sure many of us know, Wisconsin is home to plenty of interesting, sometimes unusual competitions. I'm thinking the cow chip throw later this summer, for example. But there's one taking place over the next couple of days that really caught our attention.
The town of Monona is hosting the 2014 Wisconsin Wife Carry Championship, the idea being that you pick up your wife or significant other and race to the finish line.
Today in Curious Wisconsin, we take a look at this offbeat competition, the Wife Carry. Here to help us do that is James Bisbee. He's president of the Monona Community Festival, where the championship is taking place. James, thanks for coming up to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, okay, you've got a summer festival in Wisconsin. You check off food, yep, beer, okay, music, uh-huh. And now wife carrying. Where did that come from?
Well, our past president was from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and is of Finnish descent. Mm-hmm. And up in the UP, they've had for years up there, he said, we have a wife carry competition. And he explained a little bit more to it, and we decided to host our own wife, Carrie, competition in Monona.
And you've adopted some, I understand. It isn't just carrying of wives. We can carry any spouse or
loved one. You know what? If you've got a dog and it weighs a minimum of 110 pounds, we don't care if you carry the dog. But you've got the person being carried has to weigh 110 pounds.
Or more. Okay.
Or more.
Now describe this. You've had this before. This isn't the first one.
No, this is about our 8th or 9th year anyway.
And how many people are out there running, carrying a human or substantially weighty non-human?
Well, we generally have about 25 contestants, or pairs, I should say. And this year, our preliminary counts are up, and a lot of people register at the time of the event as well.
Okay, and so 25 or more pairs, how long do they have to carry here?
It's 253 meters, and it's an obstacle course. So you carry the person on your back or any way you wish to carry that person. And there are water hazards where you'll have to wade in through water. You will have to climb over 4 or 5 feet of hay bales. You will have very similar to what football players do in their training is the tire run. And so you're hustling pretty good. You go against the clock, and the best time wins the championship.
You got to be in pretty good shape to do this. I couldn't carry 110 pounds of anything over that obstacle course.
Well, a lot of people think it's funny, and it is great to watch, but it's a grueling competition, and typically the people that win this are in very good physical shape. It's not something where you have a couple of beers in a beer tent and you said, hey, I can take my wife and do this. I don't think it's going to work out too well for you.
And I bet there are those casual fairgoers who give it a shot. They don't make it?
No doubt about it. We've had people in blue jeans and motorcycle boots try it. But typically, the last couple of years, we've had the winner last year was a rugby player. He's got the weight belt on, and his significant other weighed a minimum. She weighed the 110 pounds. Mm. Now, if you don't weigh 110 pounds, we put a backpack on you, and we weight it down with rocks until you weigh 110 pounds. So there's nobody getting in there that's at 90 pounds.
Now, I mentioned the cow chip throw earlier, and you saw there were some people who knew what they were doing, some people who don't. The ones who win, the ones who finish the race, how do they carry their partner?
Generally, they carry it in a fireman's, or I should say, I think it's called the Estonian carry. So their legs are around their neck. They're carried on the back, and the face of the person being carried would be in the rear end area of the person being carried. Now, the person being carried also has to wear a helmet.
Oh, okay.
For
that's a good safety
reasons.
Precaution.
Yes.
So an Estonian carry and a Finnish tradition in the same neck of the woods there.
Right.
I got to ask, what do you win?
Well, the carrier, the person carried, she wins her weight, or whoever's being carried wins her weight in beer. We put her on a teeter-totter, basically, and we start stacking cases of beer until we get that 110 pounds or whatever she has of beer, and we'll go all the way down to a 12-ounce can of beer to get it exact. And then she will also win $5 for every pound she weighs. So typically you have a minimum of whatever, 110 times 5, 600 and some dollars minimum.
So wait, the person being carried wins all the prize?
No. Well, hopefully
they split it.
They split it. But he wins her weight in beer.
Okay, that's awkward.
And then she wins the cash.
Okay. And there are, I think you have a new category this year, 40 plus.
We do have a 40 plus category. We'll see how many we get. We've had a request for that the last few years, and we decided to accommodate them. And so we'll see what happens there. We'd love to even get an over 50 competition if we could.
All right, if you get enough people
showing
up. We get
enough people, right.
You're doing this in Dane County. Anyone objecting to this idea of wife carrying as a tradition?
No, not really, because as we say, it can be your partner, it can be anybody you want. We don't care. We've had everybody in all persuasions, if you will, run the race, and we're happy to accommodate anybody. The only requirement is that both participants have to be 21 years old.
Have you done this?
I have not done that.
Okay, tell us, as a spectator, why should we show up and check this out? Why is this a fun thing to watch?
Well, the crowd is significant. We will have, there'll be 20 deep on the track. It's comical to watch, although I don't think the person carrying the person thinks it's funny. But it's really a unique competition. If the person falls along the way, it's a 15-second penalty.
Uh-oh.
So that goes against the clock. Typically, if you fall, you're probably out of the race because you're going against 20-some other people, and usually there's a few that don't fall.
And this is being called the state championship. There are others in the state. Are people going to come from some of these other competitions to compete, do you know?
Well, we're the only one that's sanctioned by the Wife Carry Championship. So the winner of our race qualifies for the North American Championship in Maine. And there, if you win it in Maine, you go to the World Championship in Helsinki. So we're the only one that's sanctioned. We've been sanctioned by the National Wife Carry Association, and so we're the only one. So we've had people from out of state even come to compete on this, just so they can get qualified.
So if people around the state want to get into the international scene, the road goes through Monona.
Comes right through the city of Monona. You bet.
Couple quick other highlights apart from the carrying race. What else do we got at the festival?
We've got a wonderful art fair all day on the 4th of July. We have there's one of the feathers in our cap. We have the Kids from Wisconsin coming this year, which is a 40-piece show choir band. It's the best of the best of high school seniors or first-year college students, all Wisconsin-based youth, and they travel all around the state. They're very big at the state fair. They do 2 shows a day at the state fair, at the state fair
park. I've seen them at the state fair, yeah.
Yeah, they're really quite good.
Well, James, thanks for joining us, and I wish you good weather for the festival.
Thank you very much. We hope to see everybody out there.
That was James Bisbee. He's president of the Monona Community Festival.